If you're taking care of a senior loved one, then you know it can be hard. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason why 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Experienced senior caregivers can help with everything from meal prep to taking your loved one to doctor's appointments. And every caregiver you hire is background checked. So important for peace of mind. Find full-time, part-time, or even occasional help that fits your family's schedule and budget. Get the support you need with Care.com.
This summer, Instacart presents famous summer flavors coming to your front door or pool or hotel.
Your grocery delivery has arrived, sir.
That was faster than room service.
No violins in the lobby.
Oh, seriously? Anyway, sit back, relax, and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Starring your favorite snacks, drinks, and more.
Download Instacart for free delivery on your first three orders. Rated H for hungry audiences. Offer valid for a limited time. Minimum $10 per order. Excludes restaurants. Additional terms and fees apply.
Hello, I'm Matt Cholley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, Stand and Deliver, as Keir Starmer plans to announce 35 different pieces of legislation. We ask, how do you actually turn all of that into reality with an American academic who is an expert on deliverism and two former policy wonks, the head of Tony Blair's delivery unit and Keir Starmer's former head of policy, on how to turn words into action? Plus, we'll check in on The Tory Apprentice, the long-running reality TV series that everyone is gripped to, the race to become the next Tory leader. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. It's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Honestly, I take a day off and look what happens. All the news. Football doesn't come home. Someone tries to kill Donald Trump. Then he picks JD Sports as his running mate. I mean, I wasn't really paying full attention. I might have misheard that. And I'm not even aware, not even got a bandage on me, yes. At least it wasn't Sports Direct. He'd have ended up with a massive mug. Well, the news just keeps on coming. After I told you last week that Downing Street had a novel way of telling people how to get in touch.
I'm sorry the Prime Minister cannot take your call personally. Alternatively, you can fax on 0207 925 0918.
So, yeah, you could fax Keir Starmer. You could fax Keir Starmer, which I wrote about it in my column in The Times on Saturday. So, this morning, I called Downing Street again.
Hello, you have reached the Downing Street switchboard. Please hold for an operator. For full details on the...
You can't send him a fax anymore!
...and how we handle your private data...
They've just got...
Please go to...
You can't... You're not being asked to write to him...
Colon...
And you're not being invited to send him a fax... Or email the website, which is the other thing.
UK forward slash...
That is the power.
...privacynotice.html.
The power that I wield. Sorry, I hung up before I went through. So it's gone. It's gone. They've got rid of the facts. I mean, it's a shame they didn't take as much notice of my column the week before in The Times when I said that Keir Starmer should get rid of Larry the Cat. Yeah, all right, we don't listen enough of that.
In a time of economic uncertainty, bold players can win big. Fighting it out.
This is not Big Brother is watching you. This is Suella Braverman beaming in. We were going to stop the lunatic woke virus working its way through the British state.
Behind me it says popcorn. And I'm not sure we're either popular and I don't think we were very conservative.
This is an opportunity of a lifetime.
A punishing selection process.
Winning nationally was always going to be a battle. I did hope to succeed here, but also with aspirations to potentially lead my party one day.
It is wonderful that so many have come together today to not gloat at the colleagues we wanted to lose and lost.
It's down to business with The Apprentice.
You're fired. You're fired. It's a total disgrace. You're fired.
Yeah, it's the reality TV show that everyone is watching closely. Who will become the Tory apprentice? Who will become the next Tory leader? Katie Balls, the Spectator's political editor, is watching so that you don't have to. Katie, well, how many weeks is it? Two weeks? 10 days since the election. I've lost track. Nearly 2 weeks. It feels like we're still none the wiser. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it tells you everything that we're currently at the point where no one in the Tory party can agree. But right now, it's not even about who should be leader. No one can agree on the timing. No one can agree on the basic rules of this Tory leadership contest. And we may get some clarity later this week when the Conservative board meet, and that will set out the timeline. But it has taken some time because there's the go long crowd who want to wait a very long time and the hope problems start to go away. And the go now crowd who think, actually, we're going to have a fight, whatever. So why not just have a fight tomorrow?
And suggestions as well today in the Times that the Tory party hasn't got any money to run its own standalone election, so they might just tag it on to having the hustings at the party conference in October.
Yeah, I think finance is a factor, of course, because the Tories raised a lot of money in advance of the election campaign. But we know once the campaign got off the ground, they were really struggling to bring in any more donations. Labour did a lot better, whether it's grassroots or just attracting donors. And that is a factor, which is how does a party which is diminished, keep funding itself? Labour have had that when in opposition. But I do think there was always a sense that party conference provided a platform, whether it is for the membership to be involved or for the new leader to have an audience. So I think that's also a big decision in terms of what they do.
Although we've heard a lot from Suella Braverman, I haven't really heard from any of the other major candidates. Robert Jenrick did his weird, I'm not here to talk about the leadership interview on the telly, but Kemi Badenoch has been keeping very quiet.
Yeah, I mean, they really need to keep doing more so you can keep your slot going.
I know, it's basically thank you for recognising the trouble with this feature, Katie.
No problem. But I think you're in luck. Effectively, what's happening is no one wants to put their head above the parapet because lots of MPs and lots of fallen MPs are really upset still about the result. And therefore, I think all the candidates fear a backlash if it makes it look as though they're on manoeuvres, making it about them right now, other than Suella Braverman. But it's telling that Suella Braverman has really had the wrath of many of her colleagues for her comments. So as soon as we get the schedule, and potentially you could have, I think, leadership candidates have to, announce their intentions before the summer, but not the knockout rounds pre-summer, then I think you'll start to get, more talking and more announcements and lots for your show, which is obviously the most important thing.
Katie Balls from The Spectator, and of course we'll be checking in on the race to become the new Tory leader again, I'm sure. Right, up next, Stand and Deliver.
If you're taking care of a senior loved one, then you know it can be hard. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason why 29 million families have turned to Care.com. Experienced senior caregivers can help with everything from meal prep to taking your loved one to doctor's appointments. And every caregiver you hire is background checked. So important for peace of mind. Find full-time, part-time, or even occasional help that fits your family's schedule and budget. Get the support you need with Care.com.
This season, Instacart has your back to school. As in, they've got your back to school lunch favorites like snack packs and fresh fruit. And they've got your back to school supplies like backpacks, binders, and pencils. And they've got your back when your kid casually tells you they have a huge school project due tomorrow. Let's face it, we were all that kid. So first, call your parents to say I'm sorry, and then download the Instacart app to get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes all school year long. Get a $0 delivery fee with your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 an order. Additional terms apply.
Jewelry can say many things on your wedding day. As a wedding band, it can say, "This is a forever symbol of our forever love." As a gift to your wedding party, it can say, "Thanks for standing up there with us." Blue Nile can help you find the piece that says it all and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com.
The Big Thing.
You have voted. It is now time for us to deliver.
Stand and deliver!
Keir Starmer promising to deliver. It's one thing saying what he wants to do then, but how does he actually turn it into reality? Tomorrow, the Labour government will unveil 35 new bills during the first King's speech of their government. But how does he turn those words into reality? Times Radio's political editor Kate McCann is here. 35 bills, a lot, but then it is the start of a government, Kate. So, you know, you do all your difficult stuff at the beginning. In a moment, we'll hear about the difficulties of turning those things into reality. What is it that Keir Starmer wants to do? What are his early priorities?
Well, his main priorities are the missions, the key missions that he set out previously, which are really all centred around economic growth and growing the economy, making sure the economy is stable. He wants to reform the NHS. He wants to deal with clean energy and crime and justice. And immigration really is the other priority. But everything that we expect to see in this King's speech will have a laser-like focus on the economy and growth, because Labour hasn't promised a huge amount in its manifesto. It's been quite cautious. But what it wants to do is much more ambitious. It just can't do any of it without growth. So that is the absolute key. And it's part of the conversation you're having. If people feel like Labour has been successful, they have to see things change. And to see things change, you have to promise things, and you can't promise them without growth. And that's, you can see that in this discussion.
And the reason they need benefits. Growth is because I said they won't put up taxes and they won't cut spending. Exactly. So if you want to do stuff which costs money, then you have to grow the economy.
Exactly.
Are they alive to the fact that actually there's this, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story about someone during the Brexit referendum was out campaigning and said, look, if you vote Leave, it'll hit GDP. And someone said, well, it might hit your GDP. It's not going to hit my GDP. A GDP just feels like something that happens somewhere else. People need to feel it in their own lives, whether it's getting a GP appointment or having more money at the end of the month or being able to afford to get a new kitchen. Whatever that thing is, they need real life improvements.
They do. And actually, it was Dominic Cummings who knew that more. He was more clued into that than almost anybody else. When Boris Johnson won in 2019 and he had that majority, I remember speaking to Dominic Cummings the Christmas after that election win. And he said, none of this will matter if we don't deliver. And we have to prove, so people have to be able to see it. He was talking about building stuff. He was saying the key is building stuff. The reality for Labour is different because the money isn't there. The economy is in a much worse position. For Labour, the really important part of tomorrow is not a long list of 35 odd bills. It's a story. They absolutely have to have a story, a narrative, a way to explain the journey that we are about to go on in the next 5 years. If they can't do that, then people won't really understand what's about to come and what has changed if and when it does. So that foundation is absolutely crucial tomorrow. The narrative, the story, what does it look like? And from there, they have to have like absolutely key moments of delivery where they can hold it up, show people and say, this is what we've done.
Thanks, Kate. Times Radio's political editor, Kate McCann there. So how do you turn your promises into delivery and then get the credit for it so you're appreciated by key voters? Keir Starmer's biographer, Tom Bolton, has said that Morgan McSweeney, the campaign chief behind Labour's election win, has been handing out a paper called The Death of Deliverism to party officials as they look forward to the 2029 general election. And this paper explores why Joe Biden's administration hasn't got the political credit for presiding over strong economic growth and keeping inflation low compared to other Western nations. So even delivering is not enough. So the man who coined the term deliverism is the political theorist Matt Stoller from the American Liberties Project. I asked him to define what deliverism really means.
Yeah, this is a very stupid debate. Let me just start with that. So there is sort of an argument. God, everything is so stupid in politics. There was an argument that a year ago, where a bunch of people were saying, hey, politicians should talk about popular things to appeal to voters, right? As opposed to talking about unpopular things. And then a couple of us said, well, okay, but also if you're running the government, you should do things for people with the government that they like. And then you should also talk about them. And the people who said you should just talk about popular things, but they didn't care about government. They called that popularism. And then we were saying, hey, you should also deliver stuff that people like, and we called that deliverism. And then there was this dumb debate about it, but nobody was actually disagreeing because nobody was saying, hey, the government shouldn't do good things for people when you're in power. They just kind of are lazy and didn't want to deal with the fact that like governing is kind of difficult. You have to get into the details. Instead, they wanted to just prance around and just have arguments in the media. So that's essentially the debate, a quote unquote debate. It's all very dumb. And there we go. And it should be pretty depressing that the mastermind of the Labour election is handing around an essay on as if this topic matters at all.
And it's your essay.
No, the death of liberalism was somebody criticizing what I said. Yeah. I don't know which essay this person was handing out, but the debate was the death of deliverism. The fact that there's any conversation about whether you should, when you get into government, do things that people like, there's a, like, we need to think about this. Like, that's just a really bad sign for Labor. And Labor didn't do particularly well in this election. They got a lot of seats, but they didn't, you know, their vote share wasn't particularly good. So they just kind of, they're the alternative, and people voted for not the people in charge. And it's very clear that they're going to get their ass kicked in a few years because they don't have any vision. And I mean, I'm just guessing, right? I'm guessing this. If the morons are handing out the topic of the, like, if they think this debate matters, it's a really bad sign for Labour.
Well, I think maybe the prism it's been seen through in the UK anyway is that Joe Biden has delivered a lot of stuff. You know, it's the Inflation Reduction Act, big investment in energy, you know, lifting people out of poverty. But doesn't seem to have been rewarded in the polls. You know, he's neck and neck. I mean, there are lots of other reasons why that might be, not least his ability to string together a sentence. So I think there's a debate about just being the competent grown-ups, which is how Labour has slightly positioned themselves, and restoring some order and getting on with the job and delivering them some things, doesn't necessarily translate into electoral success, which is what populism, promising loads of stuff and then not delivering it, is the sort of the other side of that coin,
no,
I guess.
Populism is not that. Populism is absolutely not that. Europeans have this stupid definition of populism because they're afraid of saying fascism. Populism is a farmers' movement in America in the 1880s and 1890s, where they said, we don't like the fact that railroads are stealing all our stuff. We should regulate them or have public ownership, and we should sort of have the government structure the economy in a more democratic way. And that actually is the basis for how American governance happened in most of the 20th century. Now, the Europeans, because they're elitists and afraid of actually democratic impulses, say, oh, populism, that's just fascism. And it's not. And they could just use the term fascism, but they don't, because they hate democratic impulses. And that's really where this is all coming from, right? Now, has Biden delivered? In some things, yes. In some things, no. I mean, the people are in a worse position today than they were 3 or 4 years ago, right? And so, like you know, for years, the public has been saying, we're really unhappy. Like, the economy is really bad. And the idiot economists in the Biden world, and most of them are Obama retreads, you know, Janet Yellen and Jay Powell, who's the head of the Fed. I mean, these are terrible policymakers. And they've been saying, well, our charts look pretty. And then there are actual problems with how you calculate what inflation looks like. And so, for example, they don't include the cost of interest rates in inflation. And so when people have a bunch of debt, and their debt costs go way up, that's not counted in their pretty charts. So the idea that Biden has kind of delivered, I mean, he's done some things that are different than what Obama did. And I'm really happy that he broke with 30, 40 years of bad policy, but he's only kind of broken with it. Only some parts of the administration have, and they don't talk about any of it. So it's weird, right? They just talk about, like, how many, you know, count the different identity people they have in their administration, or, you know, whatever kind of weird, dumb, boring things they want to talk about. And Biden himself is more interested in Gaza and foreign policy and NATO. And so that's what he's interested in. So nobody knows, like, the things that are good, nobody knows they're a result of what the administration is doing. And then there's a lot of bad things that the administration are doing that are kind of retreads from what happened. So what you have here is a fundamentally lazy debate, because the people who are saying populism don't pay attention to any of the policy or any of the impacts. And they just are talking to the dumb economists, and they're saying, well, all the charts look pretty, so it's obvious that doing good things for people doesn't matter, or whatever they want to say, because they're taking money from bankers. So it's like, it's all really stupid. And the fact that labor leaders can't see through it, it just indicates that they're in the same dumb mindset that the sort of top economists here have been. And then, frankly, labor has been in for decades. So I'm not optimistic about labor, because if this is the way they're thinking, they're in real trouble.
It's interesting, because it does feel like underlying this debate is the implication that you shouldn't do something, which is just the right thing to do, whether it's, I don't know, build a road or some schools or whatever it might be. You shouldn't do it unless you're going to get, you know, you can measure the points you might get on your polling ratings. That running a country is only about shifting the polls rather than running the country?
Well, in a sense, I mean, that's not, I don't object to that way of thinking. Rick, you should try to be popular if you're in power. You know, it's important to maintain public legitimacy.
Yeah.
I mean, Biden hasn't done that. And it's a huge problem. And I like Biden and I like a lot of what he's done. He's best president of my lifetime, but he hasn't done that. And that's hugely important. He hasn't talked about it. He hasn't tried to figure out why they're unpopular and address it. So that is not what I object to. What I object to is exactly what the first part of what you said is, let's not do anything unless we can prove to our own people, our own sort of internal strategists, that we can get credit for it. The strategists are idiots, right? I'm not saying I know anything, but you can't predict the future. No one knows anything. Like, my view is, you do stuff that you think people will like, and then you listen to them. And if they don't like it, you figure out why and you change what you're doing, right? Or you change how you're talking about it. Like, you learn and you iterate. That's how every good business works. That's how every good labor union works. That's how everyone makes things better. And right now we're in this weird position where we're coming out of this era of basically no governance or just deferring all governance to private bankers. And we're in this kind of moment where people are saying, man, huh, should the government do anything? Like, what, I mean, should, oh, weird. I don't know. Well, are we going to, maybe we should ask the pollsters. And it's like, if you don't have any values and you don't have a vision for society, the voters are going to know that. They're going to see that. And it's much worse, I think, in the UK, which is a little bit better than Europe. Europe is in real big trouble. It's a little bit better in the UK than it is in Europe. But it's worse than, I mean, you guys are in a worse state than America. I mean, Trump, for all you can say about him, and I'm not a fan, Trump fan, but incomes did start going up in the Trump administration. And he was talking about policy. He was talking about how he didn't like certain things that were going on with how America's integrated into the world. And the voters in the UK have made it clear they're unhappy. I mean, that's what Brexit was about. So if you don't have a vision to match what sort of some voters are asking for, then you're just kind of a caretaker government. And then the next group of people are going to come in and they're going to look really weird because you're not in touch with what the public wants. So you're going to get really scared, but they're actually just, you got to listen to voters and then deliver on what they care about and talk to them about it.
That's Matt Stoller, an American academic who's written about deliverism and how you turn what your promises are into reality and then get some political credit for it. Let's now hear from Claire Ainslie, former director of policy to Keir Starmer, and some Michael Barber, who's an author, educationalist and government advisor who founded the Prime Minister's Delivery Unit in Number 10 under Tony Blair. It's the first of its kind anywhere in the world. So what was it, I asked Michael?
It was a new thing. Nobody had done it before. So I was the founding as well as the first head of it. And the idea was, which has since been replicated in a number of other countries, was to focus on getting results. So actually delivering reduced crime, actually improving the quality of schools, actually meeting health waiting times targets and so on. And by results, I mean things that the ordinary people, the citizens, would notice, see and feel were better rather than just policy. So it was a constant focus on what you're trying to do, where you're trying to get to, have you got a plan, is it working? If it's not working, how are you going to solve the problem? And just keeping people focused. And a crucial part of it for Number 10 was I was completely focused on those results for 4 years. So Blair has to deal with a war in Afghanistan, 9/11, Iraq, everything else, various EU crises. But he's got one part of his operation that never, ever gets distracted from the results he's committed to delivering for the British people.
And presumably, though, it was very important that he laid out what the end goal was so that you were very clear about where you were aiming.
Yes. So in 2001, when I took that job on, the first 2 or 3 months we spent refining and agreeing with the Treasury, cabinet ministers and others, what the targets would be for the next 4 or 5 years. And then they were published. So anybody could see whether we were on track or not. And my job was to not allow people to make excuses when there was a problem, to get people focused, to inject a sense of ambition and to believe, however difficult the targets were, we could always get them done without extra money from the Treasury. That was my job.
Claire, do you think that the aims are clear enough for Keir Starmer's government? I mean, we had the first steps and we had sort of general, you know, more general themes and aspirations in the manifesto. Do you think did they need to go actually through the process that Michael was talking about of really nailing down what are the identifiable deliverables that they want to have achieved by the time of the next election?
Yeah, I think they do. I really like the missions and early steps because I think it's a way of us understanding what's the goal, what's the overall strategic goal, where are we heading to? But I do think that having really tangible outcomes, and those outcomes not just being the kind of big quantifiable things that might get, you know, GDP, for example, or what our growth figures are, but how people are experiencing that. So I would like that almost to evolve that approach. I'm a big fan of, I think, delivery. I'd welcome delivery at this point. But I also think you need to think about what's people's actual experience of it. So, like, if you're going to have growth, could you also have deliverables that, like, is the weekly shop going up or down? Like, those sorts of things that are really about how people actually experience some of these big macro trends, not just about, you know, figures on a chart, as much as I'm actually quite a fan of that.
And actually, you know, Rishi Sunak's found that. He set a target to halve inflation, but you're not going to get any credit for the fact that inflation is only at 5% rather than at 10%, because ultimately prices are still going up for people. You might have met the target, but, you know, people's experience is still that they've got less money. And what about some of those, like the first, actually I was just sort of thinking there, where the new Labour government on Tony Blair said, we will reduce class sizes. Keir Starmer's got, we'll hire, is it 4,000 more teachers, 6,000 more teachers, which actually amount to one extra teacher for every three schools, I think. And that's a different thing, isn't it? From a parent's perspective, thinking about their children, they can see how many kids are in their class in a way they can't see how many teachers there are in their school.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that it was an input rather than, as you say, Matt, something that people would actually experience. And I think the early steps are fine. Like, I think saying this is what we're going to do is fine. But as you say, the thing that matters to a parent is, do I feel like the government have hit this target and it feels like my child is getting more attention?
I think just to build on Claire's point, which I think is good, we set, in addition to the class size policy back in 97, we set a goal for improving literacy performance in primary schools measured by the tests of 11-year-olds. And you can, as Claire says, you can track progress towards that year on year. And eventually we got there, although a little bit late. But you also do things that people will notice. We provided money for schools to buy 23 million books during those 4 years. Parents noticed that. We taught every teacher how to teach the so-called literacy hour, effective ways of teaching literacy. And to be fair to Michael Gove later, they refined that further. Parents notice those kinds of things. So when you set a goal, you can also draw attention to the process steps that get you to the goal, more books, better teaching, all the rest of it, and class sizes. So I think it's a question of thinking all through and not getting into a kind of either-or debate. Do you have outcome goals or do you just track the processes? You can do both. In fact, to be effective, you have to do both.
And I suppose it goes back to, we've got the King's Speech coming this week and that will lay out, we will do this and we will do that. But the announcement, the press release is only the beginning rather than the end of the process. And Michael, was it the case that the delivery unit under you came about in 2001? Was that sort of recognition that between 97 and 2001, they were quite good at the announcements and not about turning that into reality?
That's exactly right, actually. I mean, I don't know if Blair uses exactly those words, but they're pretty much there in his memoirs. And that is how they felt. And they turned to me because in education, we had measurable progress that people had noticed. And we brought a discipline of delivery to the heart of government. And the crucial thing that we worked on was, if you go from number 10 to any government department, you can yell at them and bang the table and say the Prime Minister's incandescent. What that does is clam people up. We built a relationship where people would talk about the problems. They'd talk about how difficult it was to get the trains to run on time in October when the leaves are falling off the trees. They'd talk about why crime was going up when it should have been going down. Only when you get that relationship can you solve the problems. So the other thing about delivery is, it's all very well to set the goals and have the drive, but you've also got to build the relationships that make it work. And finally, if I could just mention this point, a big part of my job was to build into Blair's diary regular routine reviews of progress. Normally, lots of politicians around the world spend their whole time dealing with crises. Every 2 or 3 months, we had a health stock take or a crime stock take. And that regular use of small amounts of the Prime Minister's time is fundamentally important, because then instead of just dealing with a crisis when it comes up, you're solving a problem before it becomes a crisis.
I just wondered whether actually it's sort of interesting whether lowering your sights a bit and focusing on a few really specific things. Because actually it's the sort of thing that people tell their friends. You know, if your bins haven't been collected, you'll tell everyone. If you spent 4 hours on the phone trying to get a GP appointment, they said you couldn't go in for 6 weeks, you tell everyone about that. Yeah. And actually if you start saying, actually, do you know what, iPhone, we got through straight away. Or, you know, my child needed some special needs support and it came through straight away. Those are lived things, rather than saying, isn't it great that our GDP is outperforming that of most of the rich countries who are members of the G7?
Yeah, that's Claire's point, absolutely. And there's a time lag that's worth bearing in mind. So you deliver the outcome, but it takes a while before that seeps into popular consciousness. If you look at the popularity of the health service historically, we delivered all those waiting times targets in 2004 to 2007. And in 2008-09, the health service was the most popular it's ever been in its existence. So there's a time lag. And if Keir Starmer gets going on his missions, and like Claire, I think they're very good, if he gets progress on them, there'll be a time lag before people are talking about it in the way you just described.
Just finally then, both of you, what would you expect from the King's speech? It's obviously a big moment. You know, that whole thing is probably never more powerful than it is at this precise moment. Should it be packed with big, bold ideas, capitalised on the mandate? Should it be focused on a few sort of real-life deliverables, a bit of everything, Claire?
I think the King's speech needs to tackle some of the root causes, because they will never have a better opportunity to really tackle planning. The reason why our costs are so high, like that is the reason why our costs are so high in lots of different areas. They should use the King's speech to tackle those things, but they should just literally in Starmer's prime ministerial office or wherever the equivalent is that Michael have worked out for, have our waiting list going down. What is people's experience? So never forget that that's how it translates. But yeah, they've got to go for some big things, because there's a reason why things aren't working well now.
Michael?
I agree completely with Claire. And I would just say this, in the first year of a new parliament, that's the time when you want to do the most difficult things because of the time lag, and you want to get it done well before the next election's coming around.
That's it for today's episode of the podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe, or you can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Let's talk about something that's not always top of mind, but still really important: life insurance. Why? Because it offers financial protection for your loved ones and can help them pay for things like a mortgage, credit card debt. It can even help fund an education. And guess what? Life insurance is probably a lot more affordable than you think. In fact, most people think life insurance is 3 times more expensive than it is. So with State Farm Life Insurance, you can protect your loved ones without breaking the bank. Not sure where to start? State Farm has over 19,000 local agents that can help you choose an option to fit your needs and budget. Get started today and contact a State Farm agent or go to statefarm.com.
Are you listening to this podcast in your car or on your commute to work? Maybe while you're dropping your kids off at school. I'm Dan Snow, and on my podcast, Dan Snow's History Hit, I transport you to somewhere a little more exciting. With in-depth series and storytelling, I unravel the mysteries of the Inca at Machu Picchu, follow the footsteps of Howard Carter to Tutankhamun's tomb, and hunt down Shackleton's expedition to Antarctica. For historical adventure and escapism, check out Dan Snow's History Hit wherever you get your podcasts.